depends on it, after all. They can't afford to have little things like good taste or people's privacy stand in their way. They may be writers like you, Tengo, but they're a different breed. They don't live in your literary ivory tower. So I'd better be careful, too, I suppose. Absolutely. Get ready to protect yourself. There's no telling what they'll sniff out. Tengo imagined a small boat surrounded by sharks, but only as a single cartoon frame, without a clever twist. You have to find something the little people don't have, Fukaeri had said. What kind of something could that possibly be? Tengo said to Komatsu, But isn't this working out the way Professor Ebisuno planned it from the beginning? Well, maybe so, Komatsu said. Maybe it'll turn out that he was just discreetly using us. But to some extent we knew what he was up to right from the start. He wasn't hiding his plan from us. In that sense, it was a fair transaction. We could have said, Sorry, Professor, too dangerous, we can't get involved. That's what any normal editor would have done. But as you know, Tengo, I'm no normal editor. Besides, things were already moving forward by then. And there was a little greed at work on my part, too. Maybe that's why I had let my defenses down somewhat. There was silence on the telephone. A short but dense silence. Tengo spoke first. In other words, your plan was more or less hijacked by Professor Ebisuno. I suppose you could say that. Ultimately, his agenda trumped mine. Tengo said, Do you think Professor Ebisuno will be able to make things work his way? Well, he certainly thinks he can. He knows how to read a situation, and he has plenty of self-confidence. It just might go his way. But if this new commotion exceeds even Professor Ebisuno's expectations, he might not be able to control the outcome. There's a limit to what one person can do, even the most outstanding individual. So you'd better tighten your seatbelt. Not even the tightest seatbelt is going to do you any good if your plane crashes. No, but at least it makes you feel a little better. Tengo couldn't help smiling, if somewhat feebly. Is that the point of this call? The thing that might not be all that enjoyable, but might have a certain amount of paradoxical humor about it. To tell you the truth, I am feeling sorry I got you involved in this, Komatsu said in an expressionless voice. Don't worry about me. I don't have a thing to lose. No family, no social position, no future to speak of. What I'm worried about is Fukaeri. She's just a 17-year-old girl. That concerns me too, of course. There's no way it couldn't. But we can rack our brains here, and it won't change anything for her. For now, let's just think about how we're going to tie ourselves down somewhere so this storm doesn't blow us away. We'd better keep a close eye on the papers. I've been making sure I check the papers every day. Good, Komatsu said. Which reminds me, do you have any idea at all where Fukaeri might be? Nothing comes to mind. Not a thing, Tengo said. He was not a good liar, and Komatsu was strangely sensitive about such things. But he did not seem to notice the slight quaver in Tengo's voice. His head was probably too full of himself at that point. I'll get in touch with you if anything else comes up, Komatsu said, terminating the call. The first thing Tengo did after hanging up was pour an inch of bourbon into a glass. Komatsu had been right. He needed a drink. On Friday, Tengo's girlfriend came for her regular visit. The rain had stopped, but every inch of the sky was covered in gray cloud. They had a light meal and got into bed. Even during sex, Tengo went on thinking about one fragmentary thought after another, but this did nothing to dull his physical pleasure. As always, she skillfully drew a week's worth of desire out of Tengo and took care of it with great efficiency. She experienced full satisfaction, too, like a talented accountant who finds deep pleasure in the complex manipulation of figures in a ledger. Still, she seemed to notice that something else was on Tengo's mind. Your whiskey level seems to be going down, she said. Her left hand rested on Tengo's thick chest, enjoying the aftertaste of sex. Her third finger bore a smallish but sparkling diamond wedding ring. She was referring to the bottle of wild turkey that had been sitting on the shelf for months. Like most older women in sexual relationships with younger men, she was quick to note even tiny changes in his surroundings. I've been waking up a lot at night, Tengo said. You're not in love, are you? Tengo shook his head. No, I'm not in love. Your writing's not going well, then? No, it's moving along. Where to, I'm not sure. But still, something's bothering you. I wonder. I just can't sleep very well. That rarely happens to me. I've always been a sound sleeper. Poor Tengo, she said, caressing his testicles with the palm of the ringless hand. Are you having nightmares? I almost never dream, Tengo said, which was true. I dream a lot. Some dreams I have over and over, so much so that I realize in the dream, hey, I've had this one before. Strange, huh? What kind of dreams do you have? Tell me one. Well, there's my dream of a cottage in a forest. A cottage in a forest, Tengo said. He thought about people in forests, the Gilyaks, the little people, and Fukaeri. What kind of cottage? You really want to know? Don't you find other people's dreams boring? No, not at all. Tell me if you don't mind, Tengo said honestly. I'm walking alone in the forest. Not the thick, ominous forest that Hansel and Gretel got lost in, but more of a brightish, lightweight sort of forest. It's a nice, warm afternoon, and I'm walking along without a care in the world. So then up ahead, I see this little house. It's got a chimney and a little porch and gingham check curtains in the windows. It's friendly looking. I knock on the door and say, hello. There's no answer. I try knocking again a little harder, and the door opens by itself. It wasn't completely closed, you see. I walk in, yelling, hello, is anybody home? I'm coming in. She looked at Tengo, gently stroking his testicles. Do you get the mood so far? Sure I do. It's just a one-room cottage, very simply built. It has a little kitchen, beds, and a dining area. There's a wood stove in the middle, and dinner for four has been neatly set out on the table. Steam is rising from the dishes, but there's nobody inside. It's as if they were all set to start eating when something strange happened, like a monster showed up or something, and everybody ran out. But the chairs are not in disarray. Everything is peaceful and almost strangely ordinary. There just aren't any people there. What kind of food is on the table? She had to think about that for a moment, cocking her head to one side. I can't remember. Good question. What kind of food is it? I guess the question isn't so much what they're eating as that it's freshly cooked and still hot. So anyhow, I sit in one of the chairs and wait for the family that lives there to come back. That's what I'm supposed to do. Just wait for them to come home. I don't know why I'm supposed to. I mean, it's a dream, so not everything is clearly explained. Maybe I want them to tell me the way home. Or maybe I have to get something, that kind of thing. So I'm just sitting there, waiting for them to come home. But no matter how long I wait, nobody comes. The meal is still steaming. I look at the hot food and get tremendously hungry. But just because I'm starved, I have no right to touch the food on the table without them there. It would be natural to think that, don't you think? Sure, I'd probably think that, Tengo said. Of course, it's a dream, so I can't be sure what I would think. But soon the sun goes down. The cottage grows dark inside. The surrounding forest gets deeper and deeper. I want to turn the light on, but I don't know how. I start to feel uneasy. Then, at some point, I realize something strange. The amount of steam rising from the food hasn't decreased at all. Hours have gone by, but it's still nice and hot. Then I start to think that something odd is going on. Something is wrong. That's where the dream ends. You don't know what happens after that? I'm sure something must happen after that, she said. The sun goes down. I don't know how to go home, and I'm all alone in this weird cottage. Something is about to happen, and I get the feeling it's not very good. But the dream always ends there, and I keep having the same dream over and over. She stopped caressing his testicles and pressed her cheek against his chest. My dream might be suggesting something, she said. Like what? She did not answer Tengo's question. Instead, she asked her own question. Would you like to know what the scariest part of the dream is? Yes, tell me. She let out a long breath that grazed Tengo's nipple like a hot wind blowing across a narrow channel. It's that I might be the monster. The possibility struck me once. Wasn't it because they had seen me approaching that the people had abandoned their dinner and run out of the house? And as long as I stayed there, they couldn't come back. In spite of that, I had to keep sitting in the cottage, waiting for them to come home. The thought of that is what scares me so much. It seems so hopeless, don't you think? Or else, Tengo said, maybe it's your own house, and yourself ran away, and you're waiting for it to come back. After the words left his mouth, Tengo realized he should not have spoken them. But it was too late to take them back. She remained silent for a long time, and then she squeezed his testicles, hard. So hard he could barely breathe. How could you say such a terrible thing?
I didn't mean anything by it, Tengo managed to groan. It just popped into my head.
She softened her grip on his testicles and released a sigh. Then she said, Now tell me one of your dreams, Tengo. Breathing normally again, he said, Like I said before, I almost never dream, especially these days. You must have some dreams. Everybody in the world dreams to some extent. Dr. Freud's going to feel bad if you say you don't dream at all. I may be dreaming, but I don't remember my dreams after I wake up. I might have a lingering sensation that I was having a dream, but I can never remember what it was about. She slipped her open palm under Tengo's limp penis, carefully noting its weight, as if the weight had an important story to tell her. Okay, never mind the dreams. Tell me about the novel you're writing instead. I prefer not to talk about a piece of fiction while I'm writing it. Hey, I'm not asking you to tell me every last detail from beginning to end. Not even I would ask for that. I know you're a much more sensitive young man than your build would suggest. Just tell me a little something, a part of the setting, or some minor episode, anything at all. I want you to tell me something that nobody else in the world knows, to make up for the terrible thing you said to me. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think I might, Tengo said uncertainly.
Okay, go. With his penis still resting on the palm of her hand, Tengo began to speak. The story is about me, or about somebody modeled on me.
I'm sure it is, she said. Am I in it?
No, you're not. I'm in a world that isn't here. So I'm not in the world that isn't here. And not just you. The people who are in this world are not in the world that isn't here. How is the world that isn't here different from this world? Can you tell which world you're in now?
Of course I can. I'm the one who's writing it.
What I mean is, for people other than you. Say if I just happened to wander into that world now, could I tell?
I think you could, Tengo said.
For example, in the world that isn't here, there are two moons, so you can tell the difference. The setting of a world with two moons in the sky was something he had taken from Air Chrysalis. Tengo was in the process of writing a longer and more complicated story about that same world, and about himself. The fact that the setting was the same might later prove to be a problem, but for now, his overwhelming desire was to write a story about a world with two moons. Any problems that came up later he would deal with then.
In other words, she said, if there are two moons up there when night comes and you look at the sky, you can tell, aha, this is the world that isn't here.
Right, that's the sign. Do the two moons ever overlap or anything? She asked.
Tengo shook his head.
I don't know why, but the distance between the two moons always stays the same. His girlfriend thought about that world for a while. Her finger traced some kind of diagram on Tengo's bare chest.
Hey, Tengo, do you know the difference between the English words lunatic and insane? She asked.
They're both adjectives describing mental abnormality. I'm not quite sure how they differ.
Insane probably means to have an innate mental problem, something that calls for professional treatment, while lunatic means to have your sanity temporarily seized by the luna, which is moon in Latin. In 19th century England, if you were a certified lunatic and you committed a crime, the severity of the crime would be reduced a notch. The idea was that the crime was not so much the responsibility of the person himself as that he was led astray by the moonlight. Believe it or not, laws like that actually existed. In other words, the fact that the moon can drive people crazy was actually recognized in law.
How would you know stuff like that? Tengo asked, amazed.
It shouldn't come as that much of a surprise to you. I've been living 10 years longer than you, so I ought to know a lot more than you do.
Tengo had to admit that she was right.
As a matter of fact, I learned it in an English literature course at Japan Women's University, in a lecture on Dickens. We had an odd professor. He'd never talk about the story itself, but go off on all sorts of tangents. But all I wanted to say to you was that one moon is enough to drive people crazy, so if you had two moons hanging in the sky, it would probably just make them that much crazier. The tides would be thrown off, and more women would have irregular periods. I bet all kinds of funny stuff would happen.
You may be right, Tengo said, after giving it some thought.
Is that what happens in the world you're writing about? Do people go crazy all the time?
No, not really. They do pretty much the same things we do in this world.
She squeezed Tengo's penis softly. So, in the world that isn't here, people do pretty much the same things as those of us who are in this world. If that's the case, then what's the point of its being a world that isn't here?
The point of its being a world that isn't here is in being able to rewrite the past of the world that is here, Tengo said.
So, you can rewrite the past any way you like, as much as you like.
That's right.
Do you want to rewrite the past?
Don't you want to rewrite the past?
She shook her head.
No, I don't have the slightest desire to rewrite the past, or history, or whatever. What I'd like to rewrite is the present, here and now.
But if you rewrote the past, obviously the present would change too. What we call the present is given shape by an accumulation of the past.
She released another deep sigh. Then, as if testing the operation of an elevator, she raised and lowered the hand on which Tengo's penis lay.
I can only say one thing. You used to be a math prodigy and a judo belt holder, and you're even writing a long novel. In spite of all that, you don't understand anything at all about this world. Not one thing.
Tengo felt no particular shock at this sweeping judgment. These days, not understanding anything had more or less become the normal state of affairs for him. This was not a new discovery.
It doesn't matter, though, even if you don't understand anything, his older girlfriend said, turning to press her breasts against him. You're a dreaming math teacher who keeps writing his long novel day after day, and I want you to stay just like that. I love your wonderful penis, the shape, the size, the feel. I love it when it's hard and when it's soft, when you're sick and when you're well. And for the time being, at least, it belongs only to me.
It does, doesn't it?
That is correct, Tengo assured her.
I have told you that I'm a terribly jealous person, haven't I?
You certainly have. Jealous beyond reason.
All reason. I've been very consistent that way for many years now.
She slowly began moving her fingers in three dimensions.
I'll get you hard again right away. You wouldn't have any objection to that, would you?
Tengo said he would have no objection.
What are you thinking about now?
You, as a student, listening to a lecture at Japan Women's University.
The text was Martin Chuzzlewit. I was 18 and wearing a cute pleated dress. My hair was in a ponytail. I was a very serious student, and still a virgin. I feel like I'm talking about something from an earlier life. Anyhow, the difference between lunatic and insane was the first bit of knowledge I ever learned at the university. What do you think? Does it get you excited to imagine that?
Of course it does, he said, closing his eyes, imagining her pleated dress and her ponytail. A very serious student, a virgin, but jealous beyond all reason. The moon illuminating Dickens's London. The insane people and the lunatics wandering around London. They wore similar hats and similar beards. How was it possible to distinguish one from the other?
With his eyes closed, Tengo could not be sure which world he now belonged to.
Book 2, July to September.
Chapter 1, Aomame. It was the most boring town in the world. Although the rainy season had not been declared officially over, the Tokyo sky was intensely blue, and the midsummer sun beat down on the earth. With their newly thickened burden of green leaves, the willows once again cast dense, trembling shadows on the street. Tamaru met Aomame at the front door, wearing a dark summer suit, white shirt, and solid color tie. There was not a drop of sweat on him. Aomame always found it mysterious that such a big man did not sweat on even the hottest summer days. He gave her a slight nod, and, after uttering a short greeting that she found barely audible, he said nothing further. Today there was none of their usual banter. He walked ahead of her down a long corridor and did not look back, instead guiding her to where the dowager waited. Aomame guessed that he was in no mood for small talk. Maybe the death of the dog was still bothering him. "We need a new guard dog," he had said on the phone, as if commenting on the weather, though Aomame knew this was no indication of how he actually felt. The female German shepherd had been important to him. They had been close for many years. He had taken her sudden, baffling death as both a personal insult and a challenge. As she looked at silent Tamaru's back, as broad as a classroom blackboard, Aomame could imagine the quiet anger he was feeling. Tamaru opened the living room door to let Aomame in, and stood in the doorway awaiting instructions from the dowager. "We won't be needing anything to drink now," she said. Tamaru gave her a silent nod and quietly closed the door, leaving the two women alone. A round goldfish bowl with two goldfish inside had been placed on the table beside the armchair in which the dowager was sitting. An utterly ordinary goldfish bowl with utterly ordinary goldfish and the requisite green strip of seaweed. Aomame had been in this large, handsome living room any number of times, but had never seen the goldfish before. She felt an occasional puff of cool air against her skin, and guessed that the air conditioner must be running on low. On a table behind the dowager stood a vase containing three white lilies. The flowers were large and fleshy white, like little animals from an alien land that were deep in meditation. The dowager waved Aomame over to the sofa beside her. White lace curtains covered the windows facing the garden, but still the summer afternoon sun was strong. In its light, the dowager looked tired, which was unusual for her. Slumped in the big chair, she rested her chin on her hand, eyes sunken, neck more wrinkled than before, lips drained of color. The outer tips of her long eyebrows had dropped a notch, as if they had given up the struggle against gravity. Perhaps the efficiency of her circulatory system had declined. Her skin appeared to have white, powdery blotches. She had aged at least 5 or 6 years since their last meeting, and today, for a change, it didn't seem to bother her to show such obvious fatigue. This was not normal for her. As far as Aomame had observed, the dowager always tried, with much success, to keep her appearance smart, her inner strength fully mobilized, her posture perfectly erect, her expression focused, and all signs of aging hidden. Aomame noticed that many things in the house were different today. Even the light had taken on a different color. And the bowl of goldfish, such a common object, did not fit in with the elegant, high-ceilinged room full of antique furniture. The dowager remained silent for a time, chin in hand, staring into the space adjacent to Aomame, where, Aomame knew, there was nothing special to be seen. The dowager simply needed a spot where she could temporarily park her vision. "Do you need something to drink?" the dowager asked softly. No, thanks. I'm not thirsty. Ah, Mama answered. There's iced tea over there. Pour yourself a glass if you like. The dowager pointed toward a side table set next to the door. On it was a pitcher of tea containing ice and lemon slices, and next to that, three cut glass tumblers of different colors. Thank you, Ah Mama said, remaining seated and waiting for the dowager's next words. For a time, however, the dowager maintained her silence. She had something she needed to talk to Ah Mama about, but if she actually put it into words, the facts contained in the something might irretrievably become more definite as facts. So she wanted to postpone that moment, if only briefly. Such was the apparent significance of her silence. She glanced at the fishbowl next to her chair. Then, as if resigning herself to the inevitable, she finally focused her gaze directly on Ah Mame. Her lips were clenched in a straight line, the ends of which she had deliberately turned up. You heard from Tamaru that the safe house guard dog died, didn't you? In that inexplicable way? Yes, I did. After that, Tsubasa disappeared. Ah, Mama frowned slightly. Disappeared? She just vanished. Probably during the night. This morning she was gone. Ah, Mama pursed her lips, searching for something she could say, but the words did not come to her immediately. But from what you told me last time, I thought Tsubasa always had somebody nearby when she slept, in the same room, as a precaution. Yes, that is true. But the woman fell into an unusually deep sleep and was totally unaware that Tsubasa had left. When the sun came up, there was no sign of Tsubasa in the bed. So the German shepherd died, and the next day Tsubasa disappeared? Ah, Mama said, as if to verify the accuracy of her understanding. The dowager nodded. So far, we don't know for sure if the two events are related. But I think that they are. Ah, Mama glanced at the fishbowl on the table, for no particular reason. The dowager followed Ah, Mama's glance. The two goldfish swam coolly back and forth in their glass pond, barely moving their fins. The summer sunlight refracted strangely in the bowl, creating the illusion that one was peering into a mysterious ocean cave. I bought these goldfish for Tsubasa, the dowager said by way of explanation, looking at Ah Mame. There was a little festival at one of the Azabu shopping streets, so I took her for a walk there. I thought it wasn't healthy for her to be locked up in her room all the time. Tamaru came with us, of course. I bought her the fish at one of the stands. She seemed fascinated by them. She put them in her room and spent the rest of the day staring at them. When we realized she was gone, I brought them here. Now I'm spending a lot of time watching the fish, just staring at them doing nothing. Strangely enough, you really don't get tired of watching them. I've never done this before. Stared at goldfish so intently. Do you have any idea where Tsubasa might have gone? Ah, Mama asked. None whatsoever, the dowager answered. She doesn't have any relatives. As far as I know, the child has nowhere to go in this world. What is the chance that someone took her away by force? The dowager gave a nervous little shake of the head, as if she were chasing away an invisible fly. No, she just left. No one came and forced her to go. If that had happened, it would have awakened someone around her. Those women are all light sleepers. No, I'm sure she made up her mind and left on her own. She tiptoed downstairs, quietly unlocked the front door, and went out. I can see it happening. She didn't make the dog bark. It had died the night before. She didn't even change her clothes. The next day's clothing was all nicely folded nearby. But she went out in her pajamas. I don't think she has any money either. Almama's grimace deepened. All by herself? In pajamas? The dowager nodded. Yes. Where could a 10-year-old girl, all alone in pajamas with no money, possibly go in the middle of the night? It's inconceivable, using ordinary common sense. But for some reason, I don't find it all that strange. Far from it. I even get the feeling that it was something that had to happen. We're not even looking for her. I'm not doing anything. Just watching the goldfish like this. She glanced toward the goldfish bowl as she spoke. Then she turned back toward Almame. I know that it would be pointless to search for her. She has gone somewhere out of our reach. The dowager stopped, resting her chin on her hand, and with her hands on her knees, she slowly released a breath that she had held inside for a very long time. But why would she have done such a thing? Almama asked. Why would she have left the safe house? She was protected as long as she stayed, and she had nowhere else to go. I don't know why, but I feel that the dog's death was the trigger. She loved the dog, and the dog loved her. They were like best friends. The fact that the dog died, and died in such a bloody, incomprehensible way, was a great shock to her. Of course, it was a shock to everyone in the house. Now that I think of it, however, the killing of the dog might have been a kind of message to Tsubasa. A message? That she should not stay here. That they knew she was hiding here. That she had to leave. That even worse things might happen to the people around her if she didn't go. The dowager's fingers ticked off an imaginary interval on her lap. Almame waited for the rest of what the dowager had to say. She probably understood the message and left on her own. I'm sure she didn't leave because she wanted to. She had to go, even knowing that she had no place to go. I can hardly stand the thought that a 10-year-old girl was forced to make such a decision. Almame wanted to reach out and hold the dowager's hand, but she stopped herself. There was still more to tell. The dowager continued, "It was a great shock to me, of course. I feel as if a part of me has been physically torn out. I was planning to formally adopt her, as you know. I knew that things would not work out so easily, but even recognizing all the difficulties involved, it was something I wanted to do. I was in no position to complain to anyone if it did not work out. But to tell you the truth, at my age, these things take an enormous toll." Almame said, "But Tsubasa might suddenly come back one day soon. She has no money, and there's no place she can go." "I'd like to think you're right. But that is not going to happen," the dowager said, her voice completely flat. "She's only 10 years old. But she has ideas of her own. She made up her mind and left. I doubt she would ever decide to come back." "Excuse me a moment," Almama said. walking over to the table by the door, where she poured herself some iced tea into a green cut-glass tumbler. She was not particularly thirsty, but she wanted to introduce a pause into the conversation by leaving her seat. She then returned to the sofa, took a sip of tea, and set the tumbler down on the glass tabletop. The dowager waited for Al-Mamet to settle into the sofa again and said, "That's enough about Tsubasa for now." Stretching her neck and clasping her hands together to give herself an emotional pause. "Let's talk about Sakigake and its leader. I'll tell you what we have been able to find out. This is the main reason I called you here today. Of course, it also has to do with Tsubasa." Al-Mamet nodded. She had been expecting this. "As I told you last time, we absolutely must take care of this leader. We must transport him into another world. You know, of course, that he is in the habit of raping preteen girls, none of whom have had their first period. He makes up a doctrine and exploits the religion system to justify such actions. I have had this researched in as much detail as possible, and paid quite a bit of money for the information. It wasn't easy. The cost far exceeded my expectations, but we succeeded in identifying 4 girls he is likely to have raped. Tsubasa was the 4th. Al-Mamet lifted her glass and took a sip of iced tea, tasting nothing, as if her mouth were stuffed with cotton that absorbed all flavor. "We still don't know all the details, but at least 2 of the girls are still living in the religion's compound," the dowager said. "We're told they serve leader as his own personal shrine maidens. They never appear before the ordinary believers. We don't know if they stay there of their own free will, or are simply unable to run away. We also don't know if there is still a sexual relationship between them and leader. In any case, they all live in the same place, like a family. The area of leader's residence is strictly off limits to ordinary believers. Many things are still shrouded in mystery." The cut-glass tumbler was beginning to sweat on the tabletop. The dowager paused to catch her breath and then continued. "We do know one thing for certain. The 1st of the 4 victims is leader's own daughter." Al-Mamet frowned. Her facial muscles began to move involuntarily, becoming greatly distorted. She wanted to say something, but her voice would not form the words. "It's true," the dowager said. "They think that the 1st girl he violated was his own daughter. It happened 7 years ago, when she was 10. The dowager lifted the intercom and told Tamaru to bring them a bottle of sherry and 2 glasses. They fell silent while they waited for him, each woman putting her thoughts in order. Tamaru came in, carrying a tray with a new bottle of sherry and 2 slim, elegant crystal glasses. After lining up everything on the table, he twisted open the bottle with a sharp, precise movement, as if wringing a chicken's neck. The sherry gurgled as he poured it. The dowager nodded, and Tamaru bowed and left the room, saying nothing as usual. Not even his steps made a sound. "The dog is not the only thing that's bothering him," Al-Mamet thought. "The girl's disappearance is another deep wound for him. She was so important to the dowager, and yet she vanished before his very eyes. Strictly speaking, the girl was not his responsibility. He was not a live-in bodyguard. He slept in his own house at night, a 10-minute walk away, unless some special task kept him at the dowager's. Both the dog's death and the girl's disappearance had happened at night when he was absent. He could have prevented neither. His job was to protect the Dowager and her Willow House. His duties did not extend to security for the safe house, which lay outside the compound. Even so, the events were a personal defeat for Tamaru, an unforgivable slight. "Are you prepared to take care of that man?" the Dowager asked Aomame. "Fully prepared," Aomame assured her. "It's not going to be easy," the Dowager said. "Of course, none of the work I ask you to do is easy, but this is especially difficult. We'll do everything we can to set it up, but I'm not sure of the extent to which we can guarantee your safety. It will probably involve a greater risk than usual."
"I understand."
"As I have told you before, I would rather not send you into dangerous situations. But to be honest, our choices are limited this time."
"I don't mind," Aomame said. "We can't leave that man alive in this world."
The Dowager lifted her glass and let some of her sherry glide over her tongue. Then she watched the goldfish again for a while. "I've always enjoyed sherry at room temperature on a summer afternoon. I'm not fond of cold drinks on hot days. I'll take a drink of sherry, and a little later, lie down for a nap, and fall asleep before I know it. When I wake up, some of the day's heat is gone. I hope I can die that way. Drink a little sherry on a summer afternoon. Stretch out on a sofa, drop off to sleep, and never wake up." Aomame also lifted her sherry glass and took a small sip. She was not fond of sherry, but she definitely needed a drink. This time the taste got through to her, unlike the iced tea. The alcohol stabbed at her tongue. "I want you to tell me the truth," the Dowager said. "Are you afraid to die?" Aomame needed no time at all to answer. Shaking her head, she said, "Not particularly. Living as myself scares me more." The Dowager gave a fleeting smile that seemed to revive her a little. Her lips now had a touch of color. Maybe speaking with Aomame had helped, or perhaps a sip of sherry was having its effect. "I believe you said there is a particular man you are in love with." "Yes, it's true, but the chances of my actually being with him are infinitely close to zero. So even if I were to die, the resulting loss would also be infinitely close to zero." The Dowager narrowed her eyes. "Is there a concrete reason that you think you probably will never be united with him?"
"Not in particular," Aomame said, "other than the fact that I am me."
"Don't you have any intention of taking the initiative to approach him?" Aomame shook her head. "The most important thing to me is the fact that I want him with my whole heart." The Dowager kept her eyes fixed on Aomame for a while, in apparent admiration. "You are very clear about your own ideas, aren't you?" she said.
"I had to be that way," Aomame said, going through the motions of bringing the sherry glass to her lips. It was not a matter of choice.
Silence filled the room for a short while. The lilies continued hanging their heads, and the goldfish continued swimming in the refracted summer sunlight. "We can set things up so that you are alone with Leader," the Dowager said. "It won't be easy, and it will take a good deal of time, but I can make it happen. All you have to do is what you always do for us. Except this time, you'll have to disappear afterward, have plastic surgery, quit your current job, of course, and go far away. Change your name, get rid of all your possessions.
become another person. Of course, you will be compensated with a suitable payment. I will be responsible for everything else. Is this all right with you? Ah, Mama said. As I said before, I don't have anything to lose. My work, my name, this life of mine in Tokyo, none of them mean anything to me. I have no objections at all. And your face? You don't mind if it changes? Would it change for the better? If you wanted, of course we could do that. The dowager replied with a somber expression. We can make a face according to your wishes. Within limits, of course. As long as we're at it, I might as well have them do a breast enlargement. The dowager nodded. That may be a good idea. For disguise purposes, I mean, of course. I'm just kidding, our mama said, softening her expression. I'm not exactly proud of them, but I don't mind leaving them just the way they are. They're light and easy to carry, and it would be such a pain to buy all new bras. That's nothing. I'd buy you as many as you liked. No, I'm kidding about that, too, our mama said. The dowager cracked a smile. Sorry, I'm not used to hearing jokes from you. I don't have any objection to plastic surgery, our mama said. I've never felt I wanted to have it, but I don't have any reason to refuse it either. I've never really liked my face, and I don't have anybody who likes it especially either. You'll lose all your friends too, you know. I don't have any friends, our mama said, but then Ayumi came to mind. If I were to just disappear without saying anything to her, she might be sad. She might even feel betrayed. But there had been a problem with calling her a friend right from the start. Our mama was traveling too dangerous a road to make friends with a police officer. I had two children, the dowager said, a boy and a girl. She was 3 years younger than he. As I told you before, she died. She committed suicide. She had no children. My son and I have had our troubles and have not gotten along well for a very long time. I hardly ever talk to him now. I have three grandchildren, but I haven't seen them for a long time either. When I die, though, most of my estate will go to my only son and his children, almost automatically. Wills don't carry much force these days, unlike the way it used to be. For now, though, my discretionary funds are quite considerable. I'd like to leave a lot of that money to you, if you succeed in this new task. Please don't misunderstand, though. I'm not trying to buy you off. All I want to say is that I think of you as my own daughter. I wish you were my actual daughter. Our mama gazed quietly at the dowager, who set her sherry glass on the table as if suddenly recalling that she was holding it. Then she turned to look at the glossy petals of the lilies behind her. Inhaling their rich fragrance, she looked once again at Ah Mame. As I said before, I was planning to adopt Tsubasa. But now I've lost her too. I couldn't help her. I did nothing but stand by and watch her disappear alone into the dark of night. And now I'm getting ready to send you into far greater danger than ever before. I don't really want to do that, but unfortunately, I can't think of any other way to accomplish our goal. All I can do is offer you tangible compensation. Our mama listened attentively without comment. When the dowager fell silent, the chirping of a bird came clearly through the window pane. It continued for a while, until the bird flew off somewhere. That man must be taken care of, no matter what, Our mama said. That is the most important thing now. I have nothing but the deepest gratitude for the way you feel about me. I think you know that I rejected my parents, and they abandoned me when I was a child. We both had our reasons. I had no choice but to take a path without anything like family affection. In order to survive on my own, I had to adapt myself to such a frame of mind. It wasn't easy. I often felt that I was nothing but scum, some kind of meaningless, filthy residue, which is why I am so grateful to you for what you just said to me. But it's a bit too late for me to change my attitude or lifestyle. This is not true of Tsubasa, however. I'm sure she can still be saved. Please don't resign yourself to losing her so easily. Don't lose hope. Get her back. The Dowager nodded. I'm afraid I didn't put it very well. I am, of course, not resigned to losing her. I will do everything in my power to bring her back. But as you can see, I'm too tired right now. My failure to help her has filled me with a deep sense of powerlessness. I need a little time to get my energy back. On the other hand, I may just be too old. The energy might never come back, no matter how long I wait. Our mama got up from the sofa and went over to the Dowager. Sitting on the arm of her armchair, she grasped the woman's slim, elegant hand. You're an incredibly tough woman, our mama said. You can go on living with more strength than anybody. You just happen to be exhausted. You ought to lie down and get some rest. When you wake up, you'll be your old self, I'm sure. Thank you, the Dowager said, squeezing Ah Mama's hand in return. You're right. I should probably get some sleep. I'll be leaving then, Ah Mama said. I will be waiting to hear from you. I'll put my things in order. Not that I own so many things to put in order. Prepare yourself to travel light. If there's anything you need, we'll take care of it. Almame released the Dowager's hand and stood up. Good night. I'm sure everything is going to go well. The Dowager nodded. Still cradled in her chair, she closed her eyes. Almame took one last glance at the goldfish bowl and one last whiff of the lilies before she left the high-ceiling living room. Tomato was waiting for her at the front door. 5 o'clock had come, but the sun was still high in the sky, its intensity undiminished. The glare of its light reflected off Tomato's black cordovan shoes, which were perfectly polished as usual. A few white summer clouds appeared in the sky, but they gathered at its corners, where they could not block the sun. The end of the rainy season was not yet near, but there had been several days in a row of midsummer-like weather, complete with the cries of cicadas, which now sounded from the garden's trees. The cries were not very strong. If anything, they seemed somewhat restrained. But they were a positive sign of the season to come. The world was still working as it always did. The cicadas cried, the clouds moved along, Tomato's shoes were spotless. But all of this seemed fresh and new to Amame, that the world should continue along as usual. Amame asked Tomato, can we talk a little? Do you have time? Fine, Tomato said. His expression did not change. I have time. Killing time is part of what I do for a living. He lowered himself into one of the garden chairs by the front door. Ah Mama sat in the chair next to his. The overhanging eaves blocked the sunlight. The two of them sat in their cool shadow. There was a smell of fresh grass. Summer's already here, Tomato said. The cicadas have started crying, Ah Mama replied. They seem a little early this year. This area's going to get very noisy again for a while, That piercing cry hurts your ears. I heard exactly the same sound when I stayed in the town of Niagara Falls. It just kept going from morning to night without a let-up, like a million cicadas. So you've been to Niagara Falls? Tamaru nodded. It was the most boring town in the world. I stayed there alone for 3 days, and there was nothing to do but listen to the sound of the falls. It was too noisy to read. What were you doing alone in Niagara Falls for 3 days? Instead of answering, Tamaru just shook his head. Tamaru and Aomame went on listening to the faint cries of the cicadas, saying nothing. I've got a favor to ask of you, Aomame said. This seemed to pique Tamaru's interest. Aomame was not in the habit of asking people for favors. She said, It's kind of unusual. I hope it doesn't annoy you. I don't know if I'll be able to accommodate you, but I'll be glad at least to listen. It's not polite to be annoyed when a lady asks a favor. I need a gun, Aomame said flatly. One that would fit in a handbag. Something with a small recoil, but still fairly powerful and dependable. Not a modified fake or one of those Filipino copies. I'll only need to use it once. And one bullet should be enough. Silence. Tamaru kept his eyes on Aomame the whole time, unwavering. Then, speaking slowly and carefully, Tamaru said, You do know that it is illegal in this country for an ordinary citizen to own a handgun, don't you? Of course I do. And just so you know, let me say this, Tamaru continued, I have never once been charged with a crime. That is to say, I have no police record. Now, this may be owing to some oversights on the part of the justice system. I don't deny that. But at least as far as a written record is concerned, I'm a good citizen. Honest. Upright. Pure. I'm gay, but that's not against the law. I pay my taxes as ordered, and I vote in elections, though no candidate I vote for was ever elected. I even paid all my parking tickets before the due date. I haven't been stopped for speeding in the past 10 years. I'm enrolled in the National Health Insurance System. I pay my NHK licensing fee automatically from my bank account, and I carry both an American Express card and a MasterCard. Although I have no intention of doing so now, I could qualify for a 30-year mortgage if I wanted one, and it always pleases me immensely to think that I am in such a position. In other words, I could be called a pillar of society without the least bit of irony. Do you realize that you are asking such a person to provide you with a gun? Which is why I said I hoped you wouldn't be annoyed. Yes, I heard you say that. Sorry, but I couldn't think of anyone besides you I could ask. Tamaru made a small, strangled sound in the back of his throat that could well have been the suppression of a sigh. Now, just supposing that I were in a position to provide you with what you are asking for, common sense tells me that I would probably want to ask you this. Whom do you intend to shoot? Aomame pointed her index finger toward her own temple. Right here, probably. Tamaru stared at the finger expressionlessly for a moment. My next question would probably be, why? Because I don't want to be captured, Aomame said. I'm not afraid to die. And although I probably wouldn't like it, I could tolerate going to prison. But I refuse to be held hostage and tortured by some unknown bunch of people. I just don't want to give away anybody's name. Do you see what I am saying? I think I do. I don't plan to shoot anybody or to rob a bank, so I don't need some big 20-shot semi-automatic. I want something compact, without much kick. A drug would be another option. It's more practical than trying to get a hold of a gun. taking out a drug and swallowing it would take time. Before I could crush a capsule in my teeth, somebody might stick a hand in my mouth and stop me. With a gun?